welcome to the very first episode of The Now Age, which is a new podcast from me, Ruby Warrington. So some of you listening may know me as the founder of The Numinous, the online cosmic lifestyle platform where we cover everything from astrology, tarot, all sorts of ideas about alternative wellness and healing. Some of you may know me as the author of Material Girl, Mystical World, and the upcoming book, Sober Curious. And some of you may just follow along on Instagram. And some of you may have found me completely randomly, perhaps because I have been lucky enough to be a guest on so many great podcasts over the years. Maybe you found me that way. Anyway, however you found me, I'm so happy you're here, and I'm so happy you're taking the time to spend the next hour or so in my company and the company of my guest today. So a little bit of background before I dive in with today's episode on how this podcast came into being. People have been telling me for the past couple of years at least that, Ruby, you have to do a podcast. And I had a lot of resistance to this idea, mainly because I do so many different things that the thought of adding something else to my kind of weekly to-do list was just like, how am I going to find the time to do this? Between running The Numinous, hosting events all over the place, co-leading Moon Club, writing books, giving talks, and still doing some journalism on the side. My background is in lifestyle journalism. I was really like, when am I going to find the time to do this? But eventually, as months went by, it began to feel like more and more of a no-brainer. For a start, like I just mentioned, my background is in journalism, and interviewing people is what I've been doing for the past 20 years. In my old career, it used to be a lot of celebrities and fashion designers and the people we featured in the magazines that I wrote for. But in later years, since I've begun working on The Numinous and really stepped more and more into my what I feel is my true path, doing what I'm doing now, the conversations and the interviews that I do with people have got more and more fascinating and really begun to go more and more below the surface and deep into the depths about what it means to be a human being in what I call the now age. I'm going to share a little bit more about my concept of the now age, that name, how I came up with it, and what it means in another episode. But for now, I just want to say that my goal with this podcast is really to take you behind the scenes of all that I do, behind the scenes of The Numinous, into the conversations I have on a daily, weekly basis with some of my favorite collaborators, some of the people I've met on my own spiritual path, you could say, but perhaps I can also just call it my own path of self-discovery, my own path back into a life of real alignment with who I am and what I feel I'm here to contribute. The conversations I'm choosing to have on this podcast are going to be with some of the people who've been really key to that path. Some of the people I've encountered along my way who are, as I see it, really leading the conversation about what it means to be a human being as we move beyond the dawning of the age of Aquarius into this fully fledged new way of being and living on the world today. So my first guest for this first episode really embodies this idea. He is a writer, a poet, a philosopher, an activist. His name is Diego Perez, and many of you may know him by his Instagram handle, Young Pueblo, where he posts daily poetry and writings on the nature of being human, the nature of self-development, the nature of growing into a more loving, compassionate, empathetic being in the world. His poems are wildly popular. He had a book out earlier this year, which was a compilation of his writings called Inward. And in this episode, we cover all sorts of things. The reason I wanted to invite Diego on, and one of the reasons I'm having him on as my very first guest, is that whenever Diego and I manage to meet in person, we go super deep with our conversations pretty quickly. So that's what you can expect in the podcast today. During our conversation, you can expect to hear from Diego about his background in activism and organizing, which he began as a teenager, and what he began to feel was missing from that part of his life, from that work he was doing. We're going to hear from him how learning to meditate or coming to Vipassana meditation helped him begin to understand a really deep-seated understanding of himself and of the world we live in, and the work that we as a collective are here to do. We're going to hear about an astrological insight that our conversation sparked in me about what it really means to be moving from the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius. We're going to hear from him about how to balance anger with love as a motivating force for our activism in the world. He's going to share a little about his writing process. His poems can seem very simple, but there's a complex process behind them. So for any aspiring writers out there who have a message to share with the world, he gives some invaluable advice. We're also going to hear about how getting sober curious was a huge part of Diego's growth and why he thinks that stepping away from the use of intoxicants can bring us deeper and deeper and faster into alignment with our path. And he's also going to share about how he uses social media as a tool for change and how we can all begin to use social media in a more proactive way. I hope you'll stay with us through to the end of the conversation. It really is a great one to kick off this series with, and I'm so excited to share Diego's wisdom with you. See you on the other side. Diego, aka Young Pueblo, or as some in my community call you, simply Young. Welcome, and thank you so much for coming on to have a chat with me today.
Thank you so much, Ruby, for having me. I'm excited.
I'm really excited. I kind of feel like whenever we get to have a real in-person conversation and not just like DM chats, we can go to some pretty kind of cool and out there places pretty quickly. So I'm really excited to see what comes up in our conversation today.
Yeah, me too.
And I guess the first place I want to dive in with you is this kind of intersection between spirituality and activism. I think this is something that you embody both as a person and in your work. And it's definitely something I've been writing about on the Numinous and thinking about just as a person for the past couple of years now, you know. Yeah. And I know that you have a background in more kind of like traditional activism and organizing. And I'm wondering if you could just give me a bit of an overview of kind of where you come from as an activist and how that path kind of opened up for you.
Definitely. So I actually was introduced even to the idea of liberation when I was about 15 years old, and I grew up in Boston, and Boston has this very sort of very active field of different forms of organizing. And I got into youth organizing with this group called Boston Youth Organizing Project. And that really sort of just, I mean, it opened up so many doors, one to my own power and to like how much we can actually change when we come together and have a collective vision. And I just really got to see how much we could do as young people. And it was literally like high schoolers organizing other high schoolers to better change our school and our cities. And, you know, going from protests to walkouts to really sort of demanding firm, tangible, material changes in our schooling systems. And even from like, you know, not having enough computers to like forcing principals to give us more computers so that we can have access to actually write the papers that they were asking us to write. Or actually changing like the guidance counselor policies so that guidance counselors could be even more supportive towards, you know, supporting us in going to college and whatnot. And this was, you know, from the time when I was about 15 to 18. And when I left, I went to college and took a break from activism and sort of just started really figuring out, you know, who I was as an individual, what I really believed in. And when I came out after that, I started to look into different worlds of activism and started sort of delving into prison abolition work, which was fantastic and is a real sort of passion of mine. And did a little bit of housing justice work out in the West Coast for about like 2 months, just met some people who were literally sort of like reclaiming foreclosed houses and opening them back up so families can move back in and, you know, getting to be a small part of that work and also just, you know, seeing what was even possible was absolutely amazing. So to me, you know, I knew about liberation and how much it could do for us on the material side. But when I started meditating Vipassana, I learned about how much of that liberation is also internal. So, you know, doing that inner work to be able to, you know, sort of end that misery that's happening within our own minds is a huge aspect of being free. And now to me, when I think of, you know, movement work, it really is, you know, having that sort of collective external movement with other individuals, but also having that personal internal movement within ourselves, you know, actually having some sort of technique that we can use to really free ourselves.
Mm. And this idea of kind of freedom and liberation, even as a 15-year-old, you know, I've only been in the US for like 7 years, and obviously there's such a politically charged climate here right now. And I'm wondering, like, 10, 15 years ago, what was in the kind of like public sphere? What was in the consciousness of 15 to 18 year old Diego that was exciting about this idea of liberation? What was your kind of like mission when you got into this?
I think there was, something that really opened my eyes was just like the material disparity. You know, like I went to a school in Boston Public Schools, and I went to one of the, you know, quote unquote, like better schools, Boston Latin Academy. But even then, in that school, you know, that it was an exam school that you have to test into, there was still like a real lack of resources. And I remember seeing other friends' schools, or just schools that I had learned about that were in the suburbs, and just had so much more access to, you know, being able to, you know, from being able to go on field trips to going on these trips to having all of these, you know, like good quality books, like all these things that just my school just did not have. You know, I remember in my high school time, I didn't go to one single field trip the whole time, the entire, like all the years that I was there. And I think in my time, it was like really the wealth gap that is obviously growing in America, and it's still growing, where, you know, just that more and more and more people are sort of like at that working class, like sort of area of like economic disparity, but people, wealth is really just not well spread. Mm. And that was like the big idea. And also like around immigration rates, I think that was a big thing that was happening in like 2004, 2005. I remember there was a massive march that happened that included all the city to sort of support people who were immigrants in Boston.
Hmm. So, I mean, in a way, like two of the very, very big kind of underlying issues behind so much of what we're seeing now as well, you know, which again sort of makes you think, well, something has been missing in the way that these issues have been addressed on a kind of activist ground level. Like there's obviously tons of work being done, but if we're still grappling with the same issues, and in fact, you could say that some of these issues are even exacerbating and getting worse, there's obviously a missing piece in the puzzle, right? Something's not landing or connecting.
Absolutely.
Do you see it that way?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's what sort of really touched me when I was younger, was that I saw that we could win. I saw that we had power to actually make real changes, but in the grander sort of macro scale, things weren't really changing. You know, it was still the same. Like we can deal with particular issues that stem from problems, but the problems like poverty, like human rights, they were still there, you know, and if you don't really take care of that root problem, then the issues that we have to deal with are going to continue coming out of that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was like, you know, what's happening? Like, I feel like we have power, we're making some change, but the bigger picture is still the bigger picture. And I think that's what really, things really connected well when I started meditating and started seeing that, you know, all throughout history, there have always been groups of people who have tried to change the world for a better place. And sometimes they fail most of the time, but sometimes they win. And then what happens when they win is that there isn't that ability to make that grander change. One, because the hegemonic system continues sort of pushing down on you and will try to stop you at whatever cost. But the other side of it is that what happens when you actually gain power, you know, if at the root of your mind, that in your subconscious mind, you haven't sort of dealt with those patterns that, you know, recreate patriarchy, recreate racism, sort of recreate a situation where you want to have more power than others, then you're actually going to continue reproducing the things that you were originally fighting.
Mm. Yes, absolutely. So let's dive into this, because I think this is like the real juice of it, right? So how did you, I read that you did your first Vipassana meditation, which is the 10-day silent meditation that you're such an advocate for, at age 24. Had you begun meditating before that, or was that like your introduction to meditation, in which case, like, talk about in at the deep end?
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I think I had meditated once for like 20 minutes, and I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I just like closed my eyes and sat there. But then I knew after a friend of mine had done the course, and he wrote me an email, you know, and this is one of my best friends. He had written me an email, and all he could talk about was love, compassion, and goodwill. And I was going through such a transformative period in my life that I knew, I was like, this guy never talks about this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what happened that was so dramatic that made him even want to mention these things. And then I knew, you know, I need some of this too. So I just hopped right on, and I found just these astonishing, amazing benefits.
Can you describe those benefits a little bit? Like, what did you experience?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, the first course was definitely very difficult. But it sort of opened me up to just different sides of my mind that, you know, were never ever cultivated. Cause you know how to read, you know how to write, you know how to speak, but do you really, you know, have you really had the time to cultivate your awareness to a point where you can really feel what's happening inside your body? You know, not just like your heartbeat, but deeper than that, like really actually feel these movements that are happening in you. And being able to sort of connect with that nature that is literally inside of me, you know, was just opened up this wealth of information that I just had no idea that was even there. I remember when I described it to my friends after I had left, the only way I could really configure what happened was that, you know, I felt like I had learned more in those 10 days than I had in 4 years of college. But it was a real sort of profound experience. And I left feeling like I had lost 100 pounds when I probably lost like 4 pounds. And
another 96 pounds of kind of limiting beliefs, right?
Yeah. I just felt like I lost so much weight, and it was really just like this ethereal, like, you know, pattern conscious weight that, you know, my mind had just, it was just the biggest relief. To be able to have space in my mind.
Which is when you really began to apply this to your beliefs around activism and change, right?
Yeah, definitely. There was a time that there was an overlap where I was meditating and I was doing this prison abolition work, and I was also working as a consultant for a nonprofit, place called the Design Studio for Social Innovation. Mm. And it was a good time, but then I knew that, you know, I knew that the side of my, you know, sort of my political analysis, which can always improve, and because it can always improve, of course, because things are always changing. But I knew that that sort of had some foundation, it had a firmness, and that this new sort of side where I was, you know, beginning to understand what this sort of, these aspects of nature that I, you know, was completely ignorant to and how important they were for my own liberation, to actually spend time, you know, getting to know myself better, doing this sort of healing work, and seeing how these two things are actually one, you know, this external and internal liberation. I knew I had to spend time on it. So I, you know, wrapped up things in Boston and ended up moving into New York City and started focusing on just being a writer. And mm-hmm. That's where the whole Young Pueblo work came from.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And I think, I mean, based on my own experiences, I suppose, of, I haven't done a Vipassana meditation, but undoubtedly my transcendental meditation practice, which has been pretty solid for like the past 3 years now, has really helped me to be able to examine some of the unconscious programming that's running behind the scenes, which is perhaps, as much as my conscious mind and as much as my actions in the world are telling one story, is somehow holding me back from fully stepping into this path of liberation or freedom that you're talking about. So I'm talking about, you know, an unconscious desire still for power, an unconscious belief that hierarchy is necessary in the world, and that having more, on a very basic level, right, having more Instagram followers is something that it's important for me to aim for. But that just, you know, my own kind of like realizations that even those beliefs are in some ways still propagating forces of oppression in the world. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about when you kind of were talking about, you know, getting to really kind of inhabit parts of your being, I suppose, that you hadn't been aware of before? Is that the kind of thing?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you said it so well. I think that there are actually, you know, from just observing myself when I'm meditating, that you can make a shift in letting go so much that it feels like you've made a serious sort of transformation in the way you think. You know, you have more peaceful thoughts, you have more kind thoughts to the people around you. But then there are these moments where, you know, these sort of like uglier, heavier thoughts just come up, this sort of meanness that, you know, you, for a second you thought you had gotten rid of it, but then you start realizing that this sort of mode of reaction, these sort of modes of intense, you know, intense moments of emotion, they happen so quickly that we're actually accumulating patterns inside of us a lot more rapidly than we are aware of. So when we start the process of healing ourselves and letting go, you know, we start letting go of things, but we don't quite realize how much we actually have inside of us. And this is sort of the daunting part, is that, you know, it's not just like one 20 minute meditation or one like 10 day Vipassana course that's going to like change your whole life. It's actually a long process of consistency, you know, and, you know, like we were saying, through TM, through Vipassana, through some sort of technique that, you know, actually helps you dig deep within yourself. But it's really the consistency that, one, not only gets out the things that are already accumulated inside of you, but two, it shows you how, when the moment comes, when a difficult moment arises, how do you, you know, behave so that you don't actually accumulate anything else inside of you? You know, it's when you can actually come into this situation with some sort of inner peace so that you can deal with it effectively and not accumulate any tense patterns.
Right. And not kind of build on or exacerbate any sort of that subconscious programming I was talking about that's still there under the surface.
Yeah, no, what I was thinking is that it's funny because a lot of what we're doing is this massive sort of deconditioning process. And ultimately, you know, what we're trying to do is let go of all of it, you know, let go of all of these old stories from the past so that we can actually be here now in this present moment and actually observe things as objectively as possible. So a lot of what we're doing is totally just about letting go and not really sort of creating new habits, because that sort of aspect of human nature, you know, the creative side of you, the part of you that is really loving and has a strong ability to problem solve, it really sort of emerges spontaneously once we let go of that heavy ego conditioning that has been, you know, defending us but hasn't really been helping us thrive.
Yeah. I'm having some like deep astrological realizations. So if this goes a little bit, if this doesn't make any sense to you, what I'm about to say, bear in mind, it's mainly for my astro mad listeners. In astrology, right, the 12th house of the zodiac is ruled by the sign of Pisces. And there's so much kind of rhetoric around how this side, this part of the chart and the sign of Pisces are all about surrender and letting go. And that can seem a little kind of vague, I think, sometimes. But it also, I'm currently studying for a diploma in psychological astrology. And in psychological astrology, that part of the chart and the sign of Pisces also rule our inherited kind of generational patterns, like our inherited lineage and our inherited kind of like, even beyond the family that we could have any concept of now, going back literally generations and millennia, what we've inherited and what we're kind of like working with or here in this plane now to release and to move on from and to surrender back into the void. And it then makes me think how, you know, we're currently still transitioning from the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius. Mm-hmm. So much of the age of Aquarius is typified by, you know, rapid advances in technology, a much more humanitarian global mindset, and a very futuristic kind of visioning, which is exactly where you go to from when you can release all of this deep, deep generational subconscious conditioning, moving into a much more collective mindset and a much more futuristic mindset. Yeah. So what you've described actually with this process that you've been through with Vipassana, which so many of us are beginning to experience in all of our different ways and share about via the medium of the internet and share about and validate for each other on social media, is about this, exactly this move from this kind of Piscean releasing into the Aquarian kind of futuristic visioning and reimagining, like radical reimagining of our society. So thank you for kind of opening up that for me. it's a really cool kind of zoomed out astrological perspective to take. So I'd love to hear what you think about this idea of spiritual activism. It's something, it's a term I began using a couple of years ago, I think, kind of as right after the last US election. And it really felt there was a massive call for people to take to the streets. I mean, literally take to the streets and protest and get very kind of physically active. And I was even thinking then about like, well, how much must we also balance that with being, you know, activism on a spiritual level? When I use the term spiritual activism, what comes to mind for you, and how would you define that idea?
I think it's a really interesting terminology. I mean, I think it's definitely the wave of the future. I personally don't always use even the word spirituality. You know, I try to use a verbiage that really helps people kind of start fresh. So mm-hmm. when I think of it, I would even maybe call it an aware activism, like a self-aware activism, because it's so interesting when we can actually look within ourselves and be able to know what is my personal motivation, you know, outside of like anger, like is there space for me to be motivated by love? And mm-hmm. when you sort of start allowing that space, because, you know, anger is a very powerful force, of course, but it mainly can, you know, it's really mainly powerful in regards to bringing things down, to destroying things, to stopping things. Whereas love is a creative force, like, right? Love is the part of us that can have that sort of nuance, more can build new systems, can sort of, you know, build the things that don't quite already exist, that can actually make our imagination go from being something in our minds to being something in reality. Mm. And I think being able to sort of create that space within ourselves, do that healing work that we need to be able to come from love, can be that, you know, that immense sort of shift that we're all wanting to, that, you know, we know in our hearts we need to be able to really make a dramatic shift in the world. And it's sort of, you know, it asks us to overcome this idea of love as being weak, or the idea of love as being passive, because mm-hmm. in reality, you know, love is it's literally the strongest force in the universe. You know, it's the strongest and most creative force in the universe. And it really has the power to help us, you know, make something new. And I love how you were using the word, you know, reimagining, because I think that's a lot of what we're doing now. It's like, what is the type of world that I would want to live in, or the type of world that I would want my children to live in? And I personally want to live and have my children live in a world that's loving, as mm-hmm. simple as that. And I think that's what this idea of spiritual activism sort of, you know, aims at, because through love, we can recreate the world. But through love, we can also stop the people who are causing us harm, because a lot of times people forget that love has the power to make very strong physical actions. And, you know, if, you know, you shouldn't let someone harm you or abuse you or anything like that. And if you are able to keep your mind in a very loving place, you can stop these people from harming you without also harming yourself at the same time.
I really love that perspective. It's making me think about how I heard once that the Buddhist definition of love, of loving someone, is simply wanting someone to be happy. And yeah, I think that's at the very root and the heart of like all of our activism, however we define that in the world. It's about wanting other people to be happy, right?
Absolutely.
And then if you think about, you know, making love is literally the root, the beginning of everything. None of us would be here. Nothing would be happen if human beings weren't making love. I do as a writer and more of a passive activist myself, I suppose, and very much someone who sees my writing and the content I put out as my contribution. I can sort of self-judge myself and get a bit down on myself for not being more kind of like active, like out on the streets, making phone calls, doing all of those kind of things. And I wonder if you ever feel that way, or how you see your work as a writer as being kind of equally an important piece in the puzzle, I suppose, in terms of us all playing our part and all making a contribution.
Yeah, I think that's really, that's such a great question. I think right now I'm in a space where I'm just focusing on, you know, writing and thinking, really like hoping to like create thoughts that will, you know, foment a very positive revolution in a way. Mm. But There's a few things. One is that I know, like, this is the area that I'm in my life. I don't know what the future is going to look like. I definitely miss organizing because it's so much fun. It's so much fun to like see people, you know, literally reclaim their power and just say totally no to something or say yes to something completely new and create it themselves. But the other side is really that, you know, we have to understand that there are, you know, we, like in all organizations, people play different roles, and people play these different roles because we have, you know, different things that we're good at. So a lot of people, some people are extraordinarily good organizers. And I remember that one of the reasons why I felt okay personally stepping back from the organizing world was because I had seen so many new leaders arise that were such incredible organizers that I thought, you know, it was almost redundant for me to do the same work that they were doing. And to actually take a step back and find out, you know, what is it that that I could add that could be special to this? And I realized that, you know, let me try to sort of help shift human thought. Let me try to, you know, make this new way for us to really get to know ourselves. Because I know if we're going to create a global peace, and even though this might sound a little trite, but we have to create a peace within ourselves to be able to use that as a foundation for a new world. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, now because I'm cultivating this within myself, then this is a good place for me to sort of stand in so that I can help people reclaim their power within themselves. And then we can, you know, continue to charge into literally reorganizing the world into a more humane place.
Yeah. I sort of feel like with your words, with your poems, you're literally planting seeds of hope and inspiration right. in individuals who come across them. And from that seed, who knows what will grow, but the seed has to be planted in the first place, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, I still go out to protests and I'm out there when the time calls for it. But I also feel okay with, you know, the work that I've done in the past, knowing that I have my heart in this for the long haul. And I think it's so important as, you know, if you are like, if you really consider yourself part of your identity as an activist or an organizer or a revolutionary or whatnot, whatever you may want to call it in that moment, that you have a long-term vision because times of rest. And I remember when I stopped and I took a break, I needed to take a break because I felt pretty burnt out too. And I needed to sort of create that space and feel okay with, you know, just sort of allowing myself that solitude to be able to, you know, understand new facets of myself that are now going to help me sort of get back out there in the future. But I think, you know, we all play very different roles. And if we all have a mind and a heart that hopes for a better world, you know, we can all do our piece, whether it's like writing, being out there. And sometimes the moment does call for us all to hit the streets and we should be ready for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we can all do very different parts.
I love that. And I also, it's making me think about how sometimes playing to your strengths and doing what comes naturally to you can feel like, quote unquote, not enough, because it doesn't necessarily feel hard enough. It doesn't feel like a challenge enough, and it doesn't feel difficult enough. And I think there is sometimes this idea that making change, doing good in the world, going against the grain, reimagining things needs to be difficult and needs to be a struggle, when actually if you're really able to hone in on what it is you're here to contribute and what your gifts are, then it can also feel easy and joyful.
Absolutely. I think something that I learned I think like 2 years ago that really changed my life, and I forget, I think this is, I don't know that guy's name. He's like a real sort of, I think it was Gary Vee. He's like a real like inspiring speaker. He was saying how if you want to be successful, you have to play to your strengths, something along those lines. And that really hit me. You know, it was like, yeah, I need to focus with what I'm good at to really sort of succeed, and not just like in writing, but in everything. And I see how that, if you extrapolate that and sort of take that to the macro level, if we all really focus on what we're good at while also maintaining a unified vision of what the world can be, then we're going to be successful.
Then we're going to be killing it.
Yeah.
Although not using that aggressive languaging. We're going to be creating it.
Yeah, I like using bringing it to life.
Yes, right, exactly. So let's talk about language for a bit. You always mentioned, you also mentioned how you know, you don't really use the word spiritual. You've told me before about how there are certain words that you really don't use, largely because you want your work to be delivering these powerful, deep, and I will use the word spiritual messages, but you want to make it as accessible as possible. And I wondered, and I'd love to hear actually a little bit about how you came to writing? Like, was writing something you always felt drawn to? Was it something you always enjoyed and had a talent for? Was there a turning point for you when you realized that you were going to focus on that?
Yeah, for sure. I think after I did my third Vipassana course, 10-day course, I knew that, and this was back in like 2013, I think, I knew that something very special was happening inside of me, that, you know, literally I was astounded by the fact that healing was even possible within myself. I was like, holy, you know, this is really happening. Like, I'm actually feeling better, and it's not me repressing anything. You know, it's not me faking it. Like, I actually feel better. Mm. And to me, that was such a miracle on its own that I knew I had to be vocal about it. And the other side of me also understood that, you know, I didn't know everything. Like, I was far from being enlightened. And but I did know that there were some special things that I was learning that I should share. Even though I know that over time, what I understand will deepen and change, it still felt worthwhile to start sharing. And that's sort of when it all started moving forward.
Well, my other kind of, my other question was really about something we've spoken about before, how your poetry can seem so kind of natural and easy. And yet I know it's very, you construct your words very carefully in order to make things as accessible and kind of understandable and relatable as possible. Maybe could you talk through a little bit about your process maybe?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. I try to come forward with a pretty universal message, you know, and one of the reasons is because I really feel that even though the contents of our mind are different, you know, we've all had very different experiences, ultimately the structure of the mind is the same. So in regards to like letting go, in regards to actually healing yourself, you know, even though we may be using different techniques to reach different areas of our mind, a lot of we experience when we're using these techniques and afterwards, let's say when we're feeling better or when we're feeling storms from the things we're releasing, they're actually very similar. So that was one of my, you know, I wanted to sort of put forward a voice that had a sense of universality in it. And the other side is that I know that, and I know from my own personal experience, that when people use certain words, because of my old conditioning, I tend to just, you know, the mind just wants to shut down and not listen. So, and I know for other people, when they think about spirituality, you know, they don't necessarily want to hear about that. But when I try to speak in a more universal tone, I know that some people will end up seeing it through the lens that they most prefer. So it's very interesting. Like, I have a lot of people who, you know, will ask me if I'm a psychologist, but then they don't have a single spiritual practice, but they see it as psychology, or other people see it as philosophy, or other people see it as spirituality, which to me is really interesting because they're seeing it through whatever lens is most mentally comforting to them. And that's really what I wanted to support, was, you know, not use any words that would, you know, sort of alienate people or shut people down. And I wanted to actually refrain from using a lot of words. Even like, you know, you go through my work, you won't even see the word God. You won't even see the word soul. You don't see these types of words because I'm actually hoping for people to just sort of focus in on more on the mind and how it works, and to be able to look a little deeper. Because a lot of times we use these words and unknowingly they become a bit of a wall where we're like, oh yeah, this is what it is. And then you don't actually challenge yourself to look a little deeper to see what else you can sort of really grasp. And I feel like that's been one of the, you know, one of the difficult parts about the way I write, and also one of the most rewarding parts, because I don't want to tell you what to believe in. I think that's for you to decide. I just want to help you know how your mind works and help you understand it better so that you can be happier. And then what you believe, that's on you, you know?
Thank you so much. I think this is such a good lesson that many of us, myself included, can think about applying to our work. And the way you described, you know, you described it as one of the most difficult, but one of the most rewarding aspects of the way that you work. I think that's also a philosophy that kind of can get lost in the social media age, in the digital age. Everyone's looking for the kind of like easy, quick fix. Mm-hmm. And actually the biggest rewards come when we really are prepared to sit and do the work. And you do that on your meditation cushion too. You've chosen the most kind of like what people might perceive as the most kind of difficult form of meditation, but you're reaping some incredibly deep rewards from it. And I think that both the story of your meditation practice and of the way that you write is a good reminder that actually the more we commit to something, sometimes the deeper the rewards really are, you know, across the board in anything in life.
Definitely. And I think it's interesting because I love how you mentioned, you know, people want a quick, fast fix. And the reality is that the mind itself is so heavily patterned. It's been literally accumulated, depending on what you believe in, either with this one life or many thousands of lives that have happened before. You know, there are some serious patterns that have been hardened and accumulated on that we sort of live our life on top of without even knowing that when you actually want to start doing the work, I think the hardest part about it is the consistency, because it's through that consistent effort that you start seeing the releases, the new sort of changes in attitude, and that clearer ability to really observe yourself in the world, to be able to get, you know, better information and have more effective actions. But it really, it depends on consistency. Without consistency, I mean, it's, you know, it's very difficult to make those deep changes.
Yeah, it's kind of like one step forward, two steps back a lot of the time. This is definitely something, and I want to talk to you about the sober curious element for a little bit, actually. This is something I advocate for in terms of my, you know, my sober curious message is like, you're not going to change the way you drink through stopping drinking during the week. You're not going to change the way you drink through stopping drinking for January. Like, if you're really committed to creating a change in a behavior pattern that you have come to realize is unhelpful to you, such as drinking regularly, which was the case with me, it really, this could be like a years long process. This could be a decades long process of just like slowly and consistently choosing something, making a different choice, and then questioning the results of that different choice. I'd love to hear from you. At what point in your journey you began looking at your substance use and chose to also address that in your life?
Definitely. I have to say to the audience, though, that this is one of the biggest reasons that I'm Ruby's fan. You're going to that place where so many other people don't want to go to. And I feel so connected to this message of sober curious, because it was when I really sort of, you know, started even questioning the intoxicants that I was taking, drinking alcohol, you know, smoking weed, and just started seeing that I liked them, but not really. And started actually noticing that, you know, a lot of the reason why I would take them was because I, you know, either felt uncomfortable with myself or in the social situations that I was in, and afterwards would kind of regret really taking them. So it was when I started really realizing that this big change happened. So part of my story is that I started meditating. So I meditate twice a day, right? 2 hours a day. And I actually started that process before I stopped drinking and smoking. So I started meditating every day, and I kept smoking and drinking, you know, on occasion too. And what I started realizing was that I was like, wow, I was like, do I even really like doing that? So that question started happening and really coming up. And after a while, I started realizing that the amount of alcohol that I was consuming was decreasing. And I decided, I was like, you know what? I was like, I actually don't really enjoy it that much. Like, I really don't like having hangovers. And I almost want to give myself the challenge of trying to just come forward totally as myself, you know, on a chemical level, just me, and seeing how life would be like that. And the third part was that I felt like it was sort of slowing my meditation down a bit, and I wanted to see if I took the alcohol out and I took the marijuana out, that, you know, if I could go deeper. And I did that as an experiment for myself. So eventually, over time, I just stopped completely. And that's, you know, when I stopped that, and then after a few months passed, and then after a year passed, I noticed that, and I looked back and I was like, wow, a lot of my most profound growth, you know, the biggest sort of changes in my mind, in my, you know, in my thoughts and the things that I would say, in my actions, and just in how I would feel, you know, came about after I stopped drinking. And I mean, I think, like, you know, people come to these moments on their own. And it's a real hard one to sort of push back on, because culture, you know, like Western culture, is so based around alcohol that it's a very difficult one to, you know, be able to create that space for yourself, this like sort of space of sobriety you know, whether you had a problem with alcohol or not, just to be able to be like, you know, I'm going to hang out and I'm just going to like drink my juice or my water or my like sparkling, you know, whatever.
It's a really hard choice to make, and it's a brave choice to make. It takes so much to go against the grain, because our conditioning is to go with the pack, to stay with what the tribe is doing, and not to mark ourselves out as different or other. That's kind of like such embedded conditioning. So thank you for sharing your journey with that so kind of openly. And it reflects very, very much my own journey as well. It was less that I was drinking all the time and, you know, messing up my life as a result of it. And it was more the fact of me thinking, just slowly becoming aware over time, how is this actually preventing me from connecting with myself on the depth that I really want to, in order to be able to bring my best work into the world, to be able to live a life that feels truly aligned with who I am and what I'm here to do, you know? And it was that internal questioning that led to me removing it from my life also. And I think that my feeling and my sense is that many more people than would ever really talk about that are having the same kind of questioning going on. And that the more of us who can be open with that as part of our path, the more it will give people permission to make a different choice for themselves also.
I think so too. And that's why I feel so empowered by you putting forward this book, because I think it's going to make real big waves. And I already see, you know, in a lot of my friends, how they're definitely consuming less just on their own. And it's an interesting effect, because, you know, I still go to bars and I still go to parties. I still go to dance parties and all that stuff. But I'm not drinking any alcohol or taking anything. I'm just there hanging out with people. But I do notice that when I'm around my friends now, especially like my closest group of friends, like they consume a little less. And I think it's sort of, there's like a quiet shift happening, because, and not because they're like uncomfortable to drink around me, but I think there's almost like less of a need to, like the more people, because I know that myself, my wife, and a few other friends, you know, we don't take these things in. But I don't know. I feel like there's a chance, there's more space, there's like a new opening that's sort of, you know, come forward for things to really shift.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm really excited to see what that brings forward into the world, you know. I guess I'd love to hear, to go back to the social media piece, because it's so prevalent in all of our lives. If you have any other kind of like guidelines for yourself and that you would like to share for really using social media as a tool for change. I think it can be, I kind of often think about it as a bit of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's something that can really steal our attention. And if we're not really conscious of with our social media use, it can suck our energy, and it can draw us into kind of quite unhealthy and debilitating comparisons with other people. And that hierarchical mindset that I mentioned earlier of like, you know, striving for more and more followers just for the sake of having a bigger platform, you know? And I wonder what your kind of personal guidelines are for really using social media as a force for good and a tool for change.
Yeah. So I think my biggest personal guideline, especially in regards to the things that I'm writing and creating, is that one, I want to only write about things, and I do so. I only really write about things that I have had a direct experience with. So if I haven't felt that truth within myself, then I won't go out there and write about it. And to me, that's really important, because that brings a sense of validity to my work. And I also try to think of myself as a scientist. You know, I want to like observe things as objectively as possible within myself and see what's happening. And if I don't see it, you know, if I like read about it somewhere and then I haven't seen that within myself, then it doesn't feel quite right to just like write about something that, you know, I haven't experienced. Mm. So to me, that's really big. And I think, I mean, some people know that, but that's not that widely known. But I really, you know, I read a lot, but I don't really read spiritual books. I read things specifically in regards to like Buddhism and the suttas, you know, things that were sort of written down after the Buddha's time, sort of describing what he said. But I read sort of like these like more archaic books, or but not really like modern spirituality. So like, I've never read like Eckhart Tolle, you know, Viktor Frankl, or any of the sort of like more modern spiritual people, or like psychologist and stuff, but I really just focus in on what I've been experiencing within myself through Vipassana. But I think in regards to social media, though, like, I'm really careful with who I follow. I try to just keep a sense of positivity in my timeline. You know, when people are in my feed, I want to make sure that the messages that I'm putting into my mind are, you know, relatively either wise or positive. I don't want anything to be like too heavy in there, because there's, you know, the world is already difficult enough as it is, that when you read the news, you know, there's so much to be able to interact with that is difficult, that I feel like my Instagram in particular almost feels like a bit of a safe place, you know? And I like to sort of keep that up, because I don't know, it feels good to just have that space that, you know, feeds me positivity, as opposed to the other spaces where, like, I use my Facebook, you know, I make sure I follow like a lot of news sources on Facebook and Twitter to like get my news, and the different news sites that I follow. But Instagram feels like, okay, this is the space that's going to bring me up and, you know, either give me the soothing that I need or the wisdom that I need to keep it up and keep moving forward.
I love that. I really, really love that. And I'm re-inspired to go and sort of cleanse my following base as well. Actually, I recommend that in my first book. And yet still, I sometimes get sucked into the mentality of like, I should follow this because it makes me feel super scared and that's going to inspire me to do better things. But actually, you're right. All I need to do is turn on my Apple News feed, and there's like plenty to get scared about in there. And so, yeah, I love that. Wisdom and comfort. Is that what you said you are looking for?
Yeah, something that's a bit soothing, because the reality is like, we all have so many different social media platforms. Mm. And obviously, you know, you should follow the news. You should know what's going on in the world, if especially if you can withstand it at the moment. Mm. But it's also fine to take breaks from it, but you don't want to keep yourself hidden from the world too.
Exactly.
But I feel like Instagram in particular, because there's a lot of great people out there to follow. So I just try to, you know, focus it in on that, as opposed to, you know, I don't want to have the same feed for every different social media that I'm following.
Yeah, good point. I remembered what it was I wanted to mention about the sobriety piece, actually. You were taught when you were talking, and this is something I say as well, regardless of whether you had a problem with alcohol or not, sobriety could be a choice for you. And I think when people ask me that, I'm kind of like, define problem. Because the alcohol problem that I identified in myself was not necessarily the problem that we see in movies and in sobriety memoirs and,
right,
and kind of sensationalized depictions of addiction, I suppose. The problem I identified in myself was that alcohol was, yeah, preventing me from being fully present in my life as the human being that I am now, you know, and the human being that I have been, more importantly, even like being able to put all those puzzle pieces together and kind of work out what had brought me to this point in my path. So that was the thing I wanted to say. And I wonder if that kind of resonates with you also.
It does. You know, it's interesting because especially with my like Young Pueblo work, I don't always talk about just like my history with different intoxicants or hard drugs and things.
Mm.
One, because when I stopped, or when I decided to stop, I was able to stop. So I'd never really quite felt like I was addicted to anything.
Mm.
I realized that my source of addiction was my own lack of love for myself and just trying to fill this void with different, you know, objects or like different, you know, different forms of intoxicants and pleasure.
Mm.
But it was interesting. I remember one time I had an event and I mentioned, you know, how I remember at one point, like I used a lot of hard drugs when I was in my early 20s. And to the point where it was like really making me unhealthy. And at one point I remember I felt like I was having a heart attack. There was like one night where I just used so much cocaine and it really, you know, I think I could have died that night.
Mm.
And luckily, you know, I was okay, but that was the last night I ever took it. You know, I threw out the bag and I never really looked back. So to me, you know, it took me a while to get to that point to stop, but I didn't really quite feel like I was addicted, because I feel like when I think about addiction, it's something when you like try to stop over and over and you have a difficulty in that, which I totally respect. You know, I see people having that struggle and I want to honor that. But I remember a woman came up to me and very kindly, she was like, "Oh, I didn't know you were in recovery." And I just sort of smiled at her. And I remember thinking about it later and thinking, you know what? I don't think I'm in recovery, because I didn't actually feel that pressure to continue, you know, to continue doing it, even though I didn't want to.
Yeah.
And when I was able, and I think that moment, that's quite the difference, is like that moment when you want to put your foot down and you stop, you're able to.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I'm very careful with that, because I think the only sort of conceptualization that society has in regards to drugs and alcohol is the idea of like addicted or not addicted, you know? So like, if you stop, then it was because you were addicted. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. This is something I come up against myself often. Am I an addict? Well, no, because I don't actually see my truth and my story reflected in these addict stories that I read about and see. So, yeah.
Right. And I think, it, you know, obviously, you know, there are a lot of people who do struggle with these things and have, you know, struggled with addiction, and my heart goes out to them, you know, and yeah. I hope they get, you know, the tools they need to overcome these situations. But there's also the reality that so many people, you know, don't have that struggle of addiction and just more so have a struggle of trying to do what culture and what your conditioning demands of you.
Exactly. Maybe the addiction is more to the conditioning and the addiction is to the doing whatever it is to fit in.
Right. And not necessarily the actual thing that you're taking, but whatever it is that's lacking inside you. And most of the time, that's just your lack of self-love.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful insights. Thank you. Diego, before we wrap up, I'd really like to talk to you. And I haven't really asked that many people on the podcast about this, but I'm kind of curious. What do you know about your astrological profile? How do you relate to any of it?
I love that. I actually wanted to tell you a funny story. I remember the other day, so like astrology is so big right now, right? Like everybody's learning so much about it, and I think it's so beautiful. And I know very little bit. I'm like a novice, you know, like I know very, I just know that I'm a Sagittarius, and my dear friend, she has like my whole chart out, you know, in saved in her like astro.com and all of that. And whenever I want to like ask her something, she just pulls it up for me.
We all need a friend like that.
My friend, Lily Evelett, who's like probably the coolest, most powerful witch I've ever encountered. But I was walking down the street one day, in Manhattan with Saadi Simone, who's a mutual friend of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he asked me, he was like, what do you think about this astrology stuff? And I turned to him and I was like, you know, I was like, I really don't know anything about it, but I think there's something to it. And we just kept walking, and then we were both like, you know, like, you know, I trust that there's something to it, but all I know is meditating, so I'm just going to keep meditating. And that's about as far as I know, you know, like I have respect for it, and I see that it's bringing people so much clarity. So I don't know, to me, whatever supports you in being a better version of you and being like a better human being, go for it.
For me, exactly. I mean, it's a beautiful tool for self-awareness that's also a language where we can discuss our numinous findings about ourself and our psyche and our soul with others, you know, who speak that language. And you're a Sagittarius. Okay, that makes so much sense. That's the sign of the writer, the philosopher, the teacher, the pilgrim, you know. So yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You and Sa both, and me with Sagittarius rising. It's Sagittarius all around. Sagittarius season. Thank you again so much for coming on today. I just love whenever we get to talk, big ideas seem to come up and come out. And so thanks again. I hope this conversation's been, in fact, I know this conversation has been super inspiring for everyone listening as well. And hopefully, well, we will get to do this in person. You're going to be co-hosting my talk at the 92nd Street Y on January 9th. So,
oh my goodness, I'm so
excited. Can't wait for that one.
I know, that's my, I'm so excited to support you for that event, because it's going to be huge, and we're going to usher in Sober Curious to like all these people, and I know we're going to have the best conversation ever.
It's going to be amazing. So I'll see you then, if not before. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and thank you again.
Likewise, be well, my friend.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. I feel like I could chat to Diego forever about who we are, why we're here, the potential that we have as human beings when we come together as a collective, the potential that we have when we really, really choose to look deeply within, to look at our motivation, to look at the wounds, the conditioning that may be holding us back, and to really make a conscious choice to make a change as we move forward. So I've recorded a few episodes already, which I'll be sharing in the coming weeks. This podcast will be coming out every Friday, and I'll be sharing on social media what you can expect from the next episode, whether it's an interview with another guest, whether it's an astrology deep dive with our resident astrologers, Bess Matassa and Sandy Citron, whether it's myself and Alexandra Roxo, my Moon Club co-host, sharing about what's happening in the Moon Club world, or whether it's just whatever else I feel like sharing that week. I'm going to mix the format up a little bit, and I would really love your feedback about what's working, what isn't, and also who you'd like to hear me talking about on the podcast. That's all for now, and I'll see you here again soon.